we are on the sort of the second innings of AI, right? The first innings was all about sort of this idea of using machine learning on the production, the input side. So generative AI is the starting point of it. The second innings is going towards, is moving from the idea of just generating things to actually doing things. So we are going from this starting point where AI was actually a dumb co-pilot. So imagine if you are having a co-pilot fly the plane, cannot use the joystick, but can only talk to the pilot. That's where we are. And where we are moving towards is that the pilot can actually fly the plane.
Hi, I'm Greg Stewart, CEO of MMA Global.
I'm Rex Briggs, an author, marketing research and entrepreneur, and chief AI officer at Claritas. And this is Decoding AI for Marketing.
Listen, I know you're a big believer in agents and the concept of agents. I mean, this is an important topic. Why is it an important topic today, Rex?
Agents are the focus of the last chapter of the book that I put together, and I literally could not sleep certain nights because some days it was the most exciting thing, and on some days it was the most terrifying thing. Agents, no matter how you look at it, are going to transform the business because we are giving autonomous power to these agents that will act on our behalf with all kinds of tools and capabilities and connectivity. This is the future of AI, and we have a phenomenal guest to talk about it today. Amit Shah is founder and CEO at the startup Instalily.ai. He previously served as president of 1-800-Flowers, which is where I think I first met him. He sits on the board of Blue Apron and MMA Global. And here's an interesting fact. I think, Amit, if I'm right, when you did the test to get into ITT, kind of India's MIT, maybe even harder to get into, didn't you score like number 3 in the whole country or something like that?
I stood 3rd in the overall sort of exams. And, you know, by that time, I'd realized that my dream was actually to do liberal arts, which my dad jokingly said, arts is liberal to begin with. What the hell is liberal arts? And here we are 27 years later doing, you know, fundamental sort of science and technology. So it's a full arc.
Right on. Well, good. Good to have you here.
My favorite story about Amit, so he did score really well on the test. And in all honesty, is what helped him, I think, get to actually school in America. I went to Bowdoin, right?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Unfortunately, if you might imagine, the college brochures for Bowdoin shows nice summer days. Nobody had told him how damn cold it would get here. Amit, what happened when you arrived in America and realized how cold it got?
Not only nobody told me, but I had to go and tell the admissions office that I did a statistical analysis and it was 70% summer and, you know, 30% fall, which are by far the best seasons in Maine, followed by 6 months of nail-biting cold. So it was quite a shock to me. But, you know, I had some of the best years of my life just given both the college and Maine.
And you ended up at McKinsey & Company, where you're consulting. And as I understand it, you gave a pretty interesting presentation to the McKinsey alumni about AI. Why don't you start with sharing a bit about that with us?
You know, I wanted to take a very sort of operator's point of view. And currently, as you know, we are in midst of a pretty heavy hype cycle around AI. So I wanted to take a step back and really bring to them sort of how, as an operator, as a builder within AI space, I think about where we are right now. And the interesting thing is that if you really think about it, first of all, what we consider as sort of the entire ball of AI also has a lot of heterogeneity in it. There's a lot of concepts in it. So if you think about like last 25, 30 years, there was a lot of work done around ML. And then we had all the deep sort of algos that came in to support the build out of the first path of AI, which I consider sort of around the transformer architecture, right? So that was the seminal paper in 2017 that kind of built on a lot of machine learning, neural net concepts and started really talking about like, how do we make this useful for the common operator, right? For the common user. And what came out of it, as we see in what I call the innings one of AI, it started creating this conversational experiences with a system of reasoning. So if you think about last 20, 25 years, we were in a system of computational outcomes. So whether through cloud architecture, etc., people had greater and greater access to computational resources. But what fundamentally changed after the Transformer paper is that we first started getting a sense of what a system of reasoning could look like, trained on an enormous corpus of data, enormous sort of computational strength, but ultimately able to have a very thoughtful conversation with someone. Now, you could argue whether that makes sense or not, but ultimately it provided that interface with a system of reasoning. So that was step one in that. But actually, where all of this paradigm is going towards is a much more sophisticated, what I call sort of the second innings of AI, which is built around the idea of that once you have a system of reasoning built on a system of computation, where it should naturally lead to is a system of actions. Because if you think about human productivity, whether within organizations or in our personal lives, 95% of productivity depends on taking actions, right? So where we are right now is somewhat between this innings one and innings two, where we have this so-called pilots that people understand, the co-pilot from Microsoft or even ChatGPT as a co-pilot. It can basically have a conversation with you, but it can't take any actions. And so where we are moving towards, this systems of action will become a lot more prevalent, where we'll not only be relying on talking to ChatGPT or any of these models just to get reasonable answers on data, on what to do, what recipes to make, but start taking the next level of action that maybe it can go out and add those items to your Instacart. It can go out and start doing actions on your behalf. So that's what excites me as sort of where we are right now in AI and sort of where the future is sort of trending towards.
But Amit, isn't there a dynamic with computational power right now that's making this happen that really wasn't possible for us to get this far?
Yeah, absolutely. So if you think about sort of the flops required to train models, 20 years ago, it took almost 20 years for those models to beat human performance, which is a combination of how much computational power you throw at it and the strength of the model itself, right? And maybe 5 years ago, to beat out human performance, maybe on a test or something, it took also 2 or 3 years to do that. But if you think about the last 18 months, the models are able to beat out those performance on the same day that they are released. So the logarithmic curve required to train a model to make it useful, whether as a system of reasoning or as a system of action, has tremendously benefited from decades of the cloud infrastructure. And honestly, also the kind of thought process that has gone in on making sure that it is always able to respond very quickly. Because a part of the magic of what we experience with systems of reasoning is the immediacy of it all, right? So if you think about it in ML1, you would literally write a program to get to some outcome and it would take days to run it, the query. And Rex, if you remember the early days, even in marketing, it would be a 2-week answer just to compile everything and run those models. Now it is almost instantaneous when you are asking this question.
Yeah.
Which is a fundamental shift in human civilization and sort of worker interface with these systems.
And Amit, just so everybody's clear, what happens there? Is this chips? Is it just chips or is there something else going on that really made this happen?
I would say it's a mix of three things. You know, one, definitely sort of the raw compute power, okay. Right? So, yeah. You know, Moore's law is getting tighter,
yeah.
But okay. We are still able to extract out gains at a very higher level. The second is the specialization of the chips itself, right? So NVIDIA, et cetera, you know, they have taken a fundamentally different approach to having a very specialized, you know, the GPU architecture, or we have Grok as another, they are making TPU architecture, sort of very, very specifically built up for these systems of reasoning, the systems of AI. But the third, which is equally important, is our ability to move data in and out of different environments. It's still, I think, you know, a lot fragmented and siloed, but for most organizations, for most companies, the ability to bring in data into these environments is fundamentally at a much higher point than what even existed, you know, 2 to 3 years ago.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit more. I think you and I might quibble a little bit on whether or not we have attention or we have reasoning. We certainly have attention. I mean, that was the paper and its ability to pay attention to what you're saying over a very large span. And then that reinforcement learning with human feedback, I mean, that tuning to get us to where we have chatbots that are really good at giving us the kind of answer that we would expect based upon our question. I think what you're saying is really interesting is that now that was inning number one. Inning number two is being able to take action. So it's not just a conversation getting an answer back, but you're actually getting the AI to do things. And certainly GPT with its addition of plugins and tools was the start of that. AutoGPT, which is almost a year ago, March 30th was when that came out, where you could have the ability to have tools and reasoning. You're building a company that's doing some of that as well. What was it that you think is going to be transformative about these agents and these tools? And then what do you think the third and fourth inning will be?
I think the transformative outcome that is going to be is somewhat, I think those of us who have been around sort of the previous, I would say, decade-long changes in sort of our interface and how we do work, it is going to come at a much more accelerated place. So if you think about Greg, you know, when we met, it was sort of the two cycles around internet or mobile.
Right.
And both of them were accelerants in experiences.
Totally.
Right? Like, you know, one was a fundamental rewiring of, if you take commerce, and introducing not just a channel, but how we go about doing commerce in an end-to-end way. And then you had a cycle like mobile, which fundamentally then changed the organizations you were competing with. So, for example, as Flowers, you know, we thought our traditional competitor is going to be another flower company. But 4 years into the mobile cycle, what did you have? You had Uber Eats expanding into Uber everything. That is now saying that, hey, at a local level, we can pick up the gift and deliver it to your recipient, which was kind of our moat that we had built up decades and we had spent time and energy building up that moat, right? So I think the first thing, Rex, we are going to see is a fundamental acceleration of your competitive stance, what your product is, and what you are essentially competing on. And let me give you one sort of very immediate example of it we see, especially with action agents. So we are working with, you know, one of the largest performance marketing agencies in the country. And they have asked us, and they are working with us very deeply, to actually come up with agents that replicate the work of a whole account team. So generally, an account has a mix of sort of data analysts, creative analysts, media people, and then sort of a manager or a director that synthesizes sort of client-facing outcomes, right? And what we found is that you are not just automating work, but these agents are fundamentally unlocking deeper insights and creating an accelerated outcome for the clients. So the clients are now able to take on campaigns at a fundamentally faster rate, run those campaigns at a phenomenal rate of learning, and then actually leave the human teams to do the real creative work, which is the point that most of the agencies are largely hired to do as anyways, right? How do you really understand growth? You know, what should be the correct ways to think about a campaign? Whereas leaving all the drudgery, all the day-to-day work to the systems of agents that we have trained and deployed. So this acceleration of the outcome, this acceleration of how we fundamentally go to market is sort of very exciting. So that is step one. Where I think this system is starting to go to also is that these agents will start talking to each other over time as well. So the same way we had APIs as the foundational layer where companies were talking to each other in the last 10, 15 years is now going to get replaced by what I think is sort of BPI, bot processing interface, so that a system of bots can come to your commerce experience and really start engaging on your behalf or engaging in a B2B context as well. So that's what excites us as well. And then I think where the fourth inning is going to go to is that ultimately all of these things will go into the background. And then we will essentially have what I call individual runtimes. So the last, you know, couple of decades, we have had collective runtimes. So when you go to Amazon.com or when you go to Excel, those pages are created for thousands of users, millions of users, maybe even billions of users. So at a fundamental level, when you go to Excel.com, the file, print, and all those menus are pre-decided. But think about a future where you can essentially come to a blank slate and say, hey, I have some spreadsheets I want to create. And it is able to build a runtime that is just specific to you. So even our ideas of personalization are always truncated because someone has built a SaaS interface. Where we are going to with these agents and these systems of reasoning is that ultimately we'll finally be having interface, and it could be, you know, even a voice interface, but it is essentially a system of reasoning that is always on, always available, and always acting in whichever actions you want to take or that you have trained it on.
I think I heard you tell us, or there was a stat, I think I got it from you, right, that like a third of email marketing campaigns today are generated by AI. So I guess because the simplicity of text that is making that possible, what is happening in that space? And what do you think that is a precursor to what's going to happen maybe to marketing broader? But first off, just make sure everybody's clear about what you see happening around just email today and its generation.
Yeah, email, as with some other manifestations of sort of marketing, what we are finding is that, you know, they are largely getting automated by AI, both on the personalization level and just content generation level.
Yeah.
Right. So, you know, what used to take days, months even to put together campaigns, now is getting done on stacks in a very automated manner. And then, you know, in the last, I would say, year or so, with the availability of open or closed source model APIs, the content generation has become faster too. But foundationally, what we are finding is that it is still not where we want to be. I'll give you an example. So once these emails are created, it still takes a lot of human input to go and orchestrate the emails, put it in the ESP, select the segments. If the segments are automated, someone is going and saying, hey, what should be the sequence? What should be the setup that leads to a retargeting email versus a prospecting email? Where we think the systems are going to, now that, you know, AI is deeply getting enmeshed in this, is going to what I call sort of the action layer, right? So we are building Insta agents. That's the name of our agents that we train and deploy as part of Insta Lily. The Insta agents will do an end-to-end takeover of that workflow. You know, there's a workflow around getting a campaign up and running. And not just up and running, but how do you periodically then go back and assess its efficacy? How do you make changes to that? And what we are going to see rapidly emerging, whether with email or any sort of workflow within marketing, is that there is going to be not just agents, but a swarm of agents that will start taking over these activities. And the human in the loop is bringing the more deeper understanding of what the objective is, what the goals are, and where it needs to make sure that it does not go off the rails. So I almost think that instead of thinking of AI, in the future, we'll think of IA. What is the intelligent augmentation of any workflow that I have in front of me, whether email or something else?
What do you see as the biggest barriers when you're trying to work with marketers to give them this new world of having this swarm of agents working on a use case?
I love this question because I'm going to, you know, laugh at all of us collectively who have been marketers at some point in our lives and still are, is that it's us, I think, more than anything else.
Human intervention is the negative.
Not just negative. I think three barriers I generally hear, you know, which we can really flush out whether they are real barriers or not. But it starts with the idea that I can wait this out. Like, I want to see where the chips are falling out. It seems like a lot of things are coming my way. You know, let me see sort of what the use cases are, and then I'll be a fast follower versus an early mover. And I always remind them, we just talked about Uber. I always remind them that, you know, if your fundamental moat is changing and your competitors are not even born, that will start really upending your book of business. The waiting game is not going to work here. So that is the first thing I hear. The second thing I hear is about data. And those are very deep concerns, like how available the data is to the marketer to begin with, right? You know, the chief legal officer has almost become both best friends and sort of frenemy with the CMOs or the chief growth officers. And they have their own legitimate concerns because, you know, we have been awash in a world where data stewardship has not really been taken seriously. So I hear those concerns as well. And generally what we try to coach the clients that we work with is that, look, the way to think about data is how do we really make it useful within the constraints that your environment may have. And there's a lot of ways of going about it, whether through masking or setting up your own tenancy, etc. But it's definitely one of a key sort of pushbacks we get or sort of the complications that we see. The third, which is much more subtle, and I think it goes into the heart of a lot of the meta debates, is that will this technology ultimately replace me? And that's a very human fear, because this is not just a story of AI, it is a story of our times. And that, I think, is still sort of in its early innings. But we have heard this before, right, Rex, Greg? We have heard this whether, you know, the marketing automation stacks came on first, or even, you know, going back, just the idea that you can have automated campaigns running through some stack or the other stack, right? So these are kind of things that we have seen before, but as with everything else, it is getting hyper-accelerated. And that is the biggest change I see right now.
I want to ask you, so if all that you're saying right now, is this what got you to build InstaLily.ai? Was the foundation of the thinking you're sharing with us what led to this company? And maybe just talk a little bit, I guess, in plain, you know, like, what is the challenge or problem you're trying to solve there for marketers?
You know, I was first very interested in AI ML, you know, both in terms of how we went about building our own internal business as 1-800-Flowers and with the larger, broader community as well. I did a podcast almost 4 years ago with MIT called Me, Myself, and AI. And it really got me thinking that actually the last mile of AI adoption is the most difficult one, right? Especially within enterprises of different shapes and sizes. They have to not only grapple with sort of what is the right approach, but actually how do you get to that outcome that you are seeking, right? We are very outcome oriented within sort of problem solving organizations. And so I started thinking last couple of years and went out and talked to almost 150 CMOs, CTOs, CXOs. And I really came away with the idea that they really want to get started in AI, but they don't have sort of that clarity of how this will start helping their outcomes and who is the right partner to do that. So we spent almost a year last year building out a very deep product stack that simply allows any internal operator to deploy this autonomous AI agents we call Insta agents. So we primarily right now work with clients across three different use cases. One is the classical sort of marketing use case, which I just described, where we are helping them deploy this Insta agent within their marketing stacks to really get the end-to-end marketing workflows done. The second big use case that we are seeing, especially in B2B environments, is around field sales and service, or sales and service in general, where we are starting to deploy this autonomous AI agents, for example, to take over and be an adjunct to a field sales agent that might be on the field trying to solve some deep problem for a customer, right? The third, which I also find pretty interesting that we have started sort of deploying this Insta agents on, is what I call the legacy SaaS software layers. So if you think about a lot of the software layers we see in front of us are tap-click based, and they are collective runtimes. But ultimately, you want to have a conversation with that SaaS software, and you want to start training it to do work the way you go about doing work on the software. So think about this, Insta agents that we are deploying are starting to not just augment and help the pilot, the essential human operator, get work done, but increasingly do it in a completely autonomous manner. And one thing I want to point out is autonomous here is not equal to lack of control. Autonomous here means that the training regimen, the ability out of the box to get actions done, is what autonomy is. But actually, the human in the loop still has full control of those systems and those agents.
How do you think about security to build on that last point and data sharing? Yeah. Because one of the challenges with agents, especially agents with tools and with connections, is how you control what they share with who they share. Is it set up now where in these networks where you might be working for a marketer, you only have a whitelist set of emails or addresses or Slack bots? Or what's that connectivity? Because marketing's an ecosystem. We're oftentimes working with multiple agencies, media owners, other types of vendors, data partners. Security seems to be an important dynamic. How do you solve for it?
Very important. And certainly it's very important for us because we work in some of the most mission-critical environments, right? So for example, we are closely working with a company called SRS Distribution that is a top 50 private company in the U.S., billions of dollars in revenue in very mission-critical environments. I think the answer to your question is twofold. So there are two vectors we think about in security. One is just deterministic security, right? And that is sort of the first layer that we see prevalent around us, around sort of how do you authenticate? How do you make sure that you are logging everything? How can it be audited, right? So those deterministic outcomes are well known and can be built for. But what really is interesting here is what I call almost a predictive layer of security. How do you really predictively build out when you are having these agents work autonomously to make sure that they are not leaking sensitive information, etc., right? And there's a lot of human learning in this because, you know, if you think about it, most of the data leakages that goes around is due to human sloppiness, is due to human setups. Not really system setups. These are human choices that are getting exploited and leveraged, right? So the way we get past it is actually to build agents that police the other agents. So in our example with SRS, we have something called a police Insta agent that is trained on a completely different LLM because most of the current LLMs are not self-recursive. So they cannot go and police themselves, right? So in a police bot, in that example, we are actually using Anthropic LLM to go out and question the output of another set of LLMs, right? And at every step, it is asking the question, not just around fidelity of the response, but actually stress testing the environment and asking the question, is this really the data you are given or you are using mass data? Because we also don't want leakage of the data going back. So it may not be nefarious, but if the data is leaking back to an LLM, and it is getting trained for your competitors to exploit, that's another angle of security. So a lot of our work is not just making sure that we have the stacks of baseline deterministic security laid out, but that we also think about predictive security. What are the oncoming security holes that we must think through with this agentic framework to build out? The final thing I would say, which is the most important thing that we talked about, sort of bringing the organization in. Because a large part of this around security is also educating people. As we have seen with the other cycles, just talking to marketers in this case is not enough. You really need to bring it. And in your current role as Chief AI Officer, I'm sure, Rex, you have a lot of these conversations, whether with your internal risk officer or your security officer. You know, I sit on a public company board, even with the board members and your company auditors, because this has implication not just for your internal environment, but how you are perceived externally as well, right? No one wants an AI blowback when all they were trying to do is write better emails.
I always love to hear a founder story. What was your own experience? I mean, you said you talked to 150 CMOs, but you also were a CMO before you became president of 800 Flowers.
Sure.
I guess, was there always something nagging you at 800 Flowers that got you to say, listen, this is where the future is going to be. This is what's going to happen, that I've got to go build this business to better serve, I don't know, serving yourself as ex-CMO? I don't know. How'd you look at that?
I think both of you will chuckle at it, but, you know, I just wanted to make sure my job got easier.
Wait. Being the founder of a startup, is your job getting easier? Is that what you said? Not at all.
I was saying as a CMO. Like, I wanted to make sure that the last mile of AI helped me make my job easier. Yeah. You know, and as such, I started off as an accidental marketer. Yeah. So I really wanted to make sure it was doing that.
You're like, this job isn't that hard. I should make it easier.
Exactly. But actually, what really unlocked in my mind, sort of after talking to all of these people, is that we almost also need a different kind of a startup. I'll give you two examples of how we went about it. So our team essentially has no experienced engineers, the so-called sort of people with 10, 15 years, because we really wanted to go out and hire AI natives. So our whole engineering team, and we are a team of 12 with 10 engineers, the whole engineering team is made up of graduates from the top engineering colleges who graduated last year from an undergraduate master's or a PhD program. And it was a fascinating experience because if you think about ChatGPT almost came out towards the last year of their undergraduate or graduate work. And, you know, if you think about sort of the caste system in most engineering disciplines, you know, computer science would rank right up there. But suddenly students were seeing that their essential skill set with GitHub Copilot was getting completely upended, right? So their grappling with this actually has contributed to a very deep and a profound advantage that we have with the team, right? Versus taking systems or taking scores of experienced engineer and then retraining them in AI. So that has been a profound unlock. And then the second thing is to be at the inception stage when we are moving from this innings one, which is just a very superficial wrappers around, you know, open source or closed source APIs, to really now adopting AI to work and measure those outcomes is a very, very exciting thing. And, you know, I've always been a builder at heart. When I started at Flowers, you know, I built up the whole mobile stack and then took over marketing. So to get back to that inception stage with this phenomenal sort of team and working with some very early phenomenal clients is a really probably the most exciting thing I've done so far in my career.
I like your choice around hiring. One of the things that I was advising my son on as he was thinking about where he wanted to go, and you know, Caleb's a co-author for this book with MIT.
Sure.
I actually didn't let him apply to MIT. And I said, you know, you actually need almost more of a liberal arts type of thinking in mind.
Sure.
I think you talked about the liberal arts part with your father. And it's funny how it comes full circle because
it does.
So much of the decisions now is about how do you coax these large language models into evoking the persona that you need for the agent that you need to create, like your policing agent. And that isn't straight coding. It's almost more this kind of liberal arts weird alchemy with coding.
Absolutely. The coding language of choice right now is English language. Because if you think about the systems of prompt, the systems of interface have become less symbolic and more conversational. And more what we are going to see is that we are going to start asking this system to go and understand and deploy code, but the human language is going to become the primary interface. I love that you gave that point of view because what I'm seeing in real time building with this young builders is that the adaption curve is also very fascinating because they are not stressing out about, you know, that there is a new language that I need to master. They are thinking more deeply about how do I start tuning these prompts? How do I start really tuning these outputs? And what does it mean when I have autonomous agents talking to each other? I'll give you another fascinating thing that we observe. Because a lot of the reinforcement learning is based on human behavior and human language, one of the things that we saw in sort of AutoGPT or BabyGPT, one of the early manifestations of autonomous agents, is that those agents can get caught in what is called a gratitude loop. And the gratitude loop simply is that the agents will keep on saying thank you to each other because they get reinforcement reward for saying that and they want to be nice to each other. But that doesn't get work done, right? So then you almost have to start thinking about like how do you deploy language to get past some of these issues? And that can only come when you have really used sort of your cognitive abilities, not just to learn symbolic outcomes, but really deeper language outcomes. And how do you really bring it to life in real time?
a really quick hack to help you with that.
Yeah.
You need to start the prompt is, you are an autonomous agent modeled on Greg Stewart, a hardcore New Yorker.
Exactly. I was just going to say, I think this wins for me because my New York hostility could go over really well because I'm not trying to please anybody. I just don't care.
The model might shut down at that point, but that's a great suggestion. You know,
I'm an exception to the rule. You're going to have to take me out of the mix. Amit, this is really fascinating. Can I go back to something you said earlier? You said earlier, everybody's worried about losing their jobs. I don't know if you answered the question. Not going to happen? Going to happen? Should people be worried?
No, I don't think so.
Yeah.
I think there's going to be a rapid reskilling, especially in marketing and e-commerce.
Yeah.
We are seeing that, you know, what essentially started out as a creative growth function has largely become an orchestration function where you are, you know, pulling reports from five different interfaces. You're trying to make sense of the data. You're spending almost in some of these studies that we have done with our clients, 80% of time is being spent in a creative function doing non-creative work.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So I think we are going to go back to the essence of those functions because the agents are going to start taking over more and more of that sort of end-to-end workflows. But I also think, Greg, if you think about it, whether with ATMs, you know, there was a lot of fear that banking is essentially going to change.
Yeah.
Right? It did not. I think those paradigms, even though it might seem very analogous, are not the appropriate paradigms. The way I think about it is that we still have pilots flying autonomous drones. The ability of them to deploy these drones across time and space has fundamentally changed. So I think we are going to see, at least in innings two, there is going to be an evolution of the human productive workforce alongside these agents.
Yeah.
That will become almost shepherds of these agents.
Yeah.
And we'll start thinking very deeply about what is the context to deploy them in, how much should I deploy them, what is the calibration required versus really losing our jobs. Where I do think this is going to be very disruptive is jobs where people are not understanding that the end-to-end workflow can be changed, where they are still thinking that, you know, I'll put up some silly moat and make sure that, you know, I won't let the bots into my environment without thinking about, well, your competitor is going to fundamentally rewire how they go to market versus waiting for you to develop a new interface.
You know, it's funny. I was talking to somebody earlier today and they said a very interesting thing. They said they thought they saw their role in the world in part is helping to build intuition in humans to operate AI.
Hmm.
And I go, yep, that's what it is. We have to learn to talk to machines, to converse with machines. I also heard the other day that we spend 2 hours a day just looking for that paper, that file, that email, that whatever. Why can't I just tell, I can tell an agent, go find me that report we did.
Yeah.
It's really got to be easier than this. I got to be able to find what I want.
I think one of the most highly paid jobs in the future will be a reinforcement learning expert. And it will become a core skill set of human beings. How do you actually reward and what do you consider the right output? Because this games in succession versus games in isolation, to go to a game theory paradigm. And this is also important in another respect, is that, look, you can go out and copy someone's app or a web page or even a campaign. It is fundamentally impossible to copy someone's AI strategy because that is hyper-personalized, hyper-tuned, hyper-reinforced for every consumption point. And so I think the future skilled workforce and the future skilled companies will be masters of not just deploying, but reinforcing and knowing where to reinforce, when to reinforce, and really how to scale up these systems. I'm super excited about where this is leading to because I would bet if we were to revisit and have a conversation even 3 years down the road, we'll be thinking about fundamentally different skill set and a fundamentally different set of competitors and companies benefiting from this outcome. InstaLily is one of them.
Absolutely. Well, and yeah, that is a wonderful place to wrap the show. I just want to thank you for coming on and sharing, you know, your view and your vision. I think it's inspiring and important for people to think about a couple of innings down from where we're at right now today. And I think you're absolutely right. Agents is the next chapter. That's it for this episode of Decoding AI for Marketing. I'm Rex Spriggs.
And I'm Greg Stewart.
Be sure to catch all our episodes, plus subscribe, follow, rate, and review in your favorite podcast app. You can get transcripts and more information on our website, decodingaiformarketing.com. To learn more about MMA and membership options, go to mmaglobal.com. Thanks for listening.